The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The state of Minnesota has become the second state in the nation to approve safe consumption sites. Senate File 2934 was signed by Governor Tim Walz on May 24th. Minnesota actually took a few steps in the right direction in this year's legislative session in addition to approving safe consumption sites. According to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, quote, people will no longer face penalties for possessing or delivering items such as pipes, bongs, syringes, or needles. If there's drug residue from marijuana to meth in one of the items, that is also no longer considered grounds for penalization, end quote. Minnesota law now also legalizes drug checking equipment like test strips, and it clarifies the legal status of syringe service organizations, and it increases the number of syringes that pharmacists are allowed to sell. Also under new Minnesota law, as of July 1st, schools will have to keep at least 2 doses of Narcan on hand at all times. Unfortunately, legislators also felt the need to engage in performative muscle flexing by increasing penalties for selling or possessing fentanyl. So it's not all good news. We have a lot of work yet to do. We knew that. But this approval by Minnesota of safe consumption sites is a win that is worth celebrating. Now let's turn to Connecticut and substitute for SB number 9, an act concerning health and wellness for Connecticut residents, to equalize access to physical, mental, and behavioral health care in the state and to strengthen the state's response to the fentanyl and opioid epidemic. This bill would, among other things, authorize the establishment of 3 harm reduction centers in the state. Now, originally, the bill allowed establishment of safe consumption sites, and this was actually approved by the House. The state Senate, on June 5th, amended and then approved SSB 9. The Senate version does not include safe consumption sites. It does include harm reduction centers, but consumption is not one of the services that these centers could provide. Drug checking services, on the other hand, are included among the allowed services, so these harm reduction centers would be able to test for xylazine, fentanyl, and other contaminants. Now, because the two versions are different, the bill's in concurrence. Once the House and Senate agree and approve a final version, assuming they do, the bill would go to Governor Ned Lamont for signature. There was a public hearing on SSB number 9 before the Connecticut General Assembly's Joint Standing Committee on Public Health back on March 22nd, when safe consumption sites were still part of the bill. Some really powerful testimony that day, so we're going to hear some of that. Dita Bhargava works with Shatterproof as an ambassador and is a board member with Liberation Programs.
I'm joined here with my 14-year-old daughter, Aria Pelletier. 1 year ago, I testified for House Bill 5044, an act concerning opioids, imploring leaders to consider passing legislation to create overdose prevention centers to stop the bleeding of precious lives in our state. I am encouraged that this life-saving notion is coming to life through SB 9, and I plead for your support. Sadly, despite our state's best efforts, overdose rates continue to climb as the insidious disease of addiction spreads throughout our state and country. One such victim was our son, Alec Pelletier, who died unwittingly of fentanyl poisoning on his 26th birthday in 2018 while living in a sober home in Canaan, Connecticut. Alec was a warm, vivacious AAA hockey player. As a teen, he suffered from a mild bipolar condition and was self-medicating, first with easily available opioids, then with heroin. In the end, Alec wanted nothing more than to live a life of recovery, empowered by the love of his family and friends. We miss Alec dearly every day. His younger siblings miss him every day as well, their older brother. And the real tragedy is that my family is far from being alone. Over the last several years, we have senselessly lost thousands of young lives like Alec in our state. Our moral, social, and economic obligation is to find bold solutions to end this crisis. The opioid-related bills passed last year were a good start, but 1,500 innocent lives have been snatched from our state since then due to overdose. We must do more. At my son's services in Sharon, Connecticut, I was told by the funeral home owner that he hosted 7 other funerals of young men around the same age in their 20s who died of an overdose in just that month. Why is this a pandemic that we cannot control? Because the fentanyl scourge in our country hunts down these innocent folks who suffer from substance use disorder before they can find a path to permanent recovery. This was my biggest fear for our son, Alec, which came to become a living nightmare. Overdose prevention clinics have proven to keep loved ones alive long enough for them to find help, and it would have saved our son's life. Like me, some of you might make decisions based on data. Well, here are some compelling facts which are impossible to turn your back on. The cost of the opioid epidemic to Connecticut is estimated at about $10 billion a year. Imagine the money saved due to avoided ambulance rides, ED visits, hospitalizations, and instead keeping people alive, working, and participating in our communities.
Excuse me, Ms. Barbara.
Provide a safe place for education by connecting individuals to treatment and resources. OPCs have been 100% effective at preventing overdose deaths, are cost-effective, reduce syringe litter in local communities, and increase engagement by visitors to treatment. Last week, some of you may have toured OnPoint, the New York City OPC. OnPoint has, in its 18 months of operation, intervened successfully in at least 819 overdoses and supervised almost 66,000 episodes of substance use.
Excuse me, Barbara, but your time is up.
I'm almost done. If I could please
complete your testimony.
In Vancouver, an OPC was established in 2003 and over 5,000 overdoses were prevented. Not a single person has died in any of these centers. The Biden administration has also been openly and strongly committed to harm reduction. Biden Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Becerra, told NPR, "We are literally trying to give users a lifeline," affirming that the federal agency is not going to intervene in state efforts to create safe injection facilities or OPCs. Please also consider the following quickly. Support SB 9, Section 6 to 9 and HB 6913 addressing wide expansion of naloxone, which reverses overdose in its tracks before death. Prioritize the opioid settlement funds to prevent of overdose death by funding OPCs. Urgently address the deadly fentanyl plaguing our communities. Fentanyl is responsible for 85% of overdoses. Imagine that dangerous chemical was anthrax being spread through our state. A few cases would lead to aggressive measures to find and punish the perpetrators. Therefore, please consider harsher penalties to deter high-level drug dealers who knowingly traffic substances laced with deadly fentanyl. And finally, expand youth programs and institute mandatory K-12 SEL education and warn kids about the dire dangers of illicit substances. Evidence-based K-12 life skill programs have known to reduce substance use disorder by up to 75%. Honorable Chairman and committee members, we don't have time to wait for bold measures. That need was yesterday. So please consider these ideas now. And if very quickly, if she may, my daughter Aria would like to say just a couple of words.
Go ahead.
Oh. Dear leaders, my name is Aria Pelletier. I miss my brother. I am pleading you to pass this bill so that could have saved my brother's life and will save brothers and sisters from going through the same sadness I went through. And while you're at it, please do something about helping to save the world from climate change.
Thank you so much, Dita. Thank you, Aria. I'm so sorry for your loss. And I'm so sorry that you had to experience this and you have to share this story multiple times just to be able to raise the awareness for everybody else. And I want to personally thank you for all your effort in how we've been working on this bill. And then helping us get to OnPoint and visit the site as well. And talking about this perhaps before a lot of people in the state of Connecticut had been speaking. So we want to thank you for that. Representative McCarty has a question or a comment, and we'll go after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll go quickly. I just wanted to say hello to you, Dita. We've corresponded before. And just to let you know that your voice carries a lot of weight to me. listening to you tonight talking about the opioid prevention centers, because I am still learning about it. But we also had in the family a tragedy with the fentanyl overdose. And I know how much the family, it really impacts the entire family. And I'd like to continue some conversations with you, with Ariel, at some point, so we can look to talk about the youth and the families and what continues to go on. So I'm very focused on listening about how the opiate prevention centers can work and to see what we can do going forward. I was unable to make the trip, but anything we can do to help these individuals that are losing their lives to mostly to the fentanyl, I think is what we have to really look at. But if you talk to Miriam Delphin Rittman, please tell her I said hello.
I will. And thank you, Representative. And we're happy to organize another trip to the On Point in New York if you and other legislators are interested in looking at it. I think, you know, a picture says a thousand words. And if you can see the people who have been saved as opposed to my son who didn't have access to one of these, I think it would really, really make all the difference in saying yes to this bill.
That was Dita Bhargava. She works with Shatterproof as an ambassador and is a board member with Liberation Programs. She testified March 22nd before the Connecticut General Assembly's Joint Standing Committee on Public Health on SSB number 9, an act concerning health and wellness for Connecticut residents. At the time, that version of SSB number 9 would have allowed safe consumption sites. You also heard the chair of the committee, State Senator Saud Anwar, MD. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Kaylin C. is Senior Director of Programs at On Point NYC.
Good evening, everyone, esteemed members of the Public Health Committee and Chair Senator Anwar. Thank you so much for having me this evening. My name is Kaylin C., and I'm the Senior Director of Programs for On Point NYC and the operator of the two first public overdose prevention centers in the United States. You've heard from many experts this evening from all around the world, so I'll not touch on their powerful testimony that speaks to the evidence that supports this intervention. I'll speak very specifically to what's happening in New York City and its relevance to what you're considering in Connecticut. First and foremost, I'll let you know that our centers have far outperformed the projections of both New York City and New York State Department of Health in terms of this intervention's ability to engage successfully a very difficult to reach and engage population of people who uses drugs in New York City. To date, we have over 3,000 people registered to the two consumption sites, one in Washington Heights and one in East Harlem. The sites have been used just under 70,000 times. That's 70,000 instances of public drug use that were picked up out of the public sphere and put down somewhere safe, private, and dignified, connected to additional supports, including mental health care, traditional medical care, buprenorphine, connections to detox and treatment centers, holistic health services, case management, et cetera. I'll also mention that since launch in November 30th, 2021, our team has intervened in just under 850 overdoses, many of them 75% fentanyl-involved overdoses, and we've only called the ambulance 14 times. The estimated cost savings to the emergency services and hospital system is well over $25 million. And this doesn't take into account the projected cost savings to police and law enforcement. In New York in particular, we have something called the Fentanyl Task Force, which means for every overdose call, detective level officers are dispatched to attend. Before opening the overdose prevention centers, it was not uncommon for up to 11 officers to attend a single overdose call. That has evaporated with the implementation of the overdose prevention centers. But that doesn't mean that the police and law enforcement are excluded from our operation. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The partnership with NYPD is something we're the most proud of in New York, in addition to, of course, the lives that we've saved and the people that we've engaged into this very unique program. We work very closely with the NYPD in both of our neighborhoods, and they don't often get a lot of good press. So I'm always keen to shout them out for being really lockstep with us in this journey to successfully launch this program. For us, working with the NYPD was not if we should, it was how we should, and the NYPD were the same. They wanted to know what we needed from them to support the operation of the site. And our simple feedback for them was, if people are afraid to use the site, it won't work. So as long as you're not impeding their access, we expect you to continue with community policing in the neighborhoods where we both operate. And we'll do our very best to take a big piece of work off your plate, which is, of course, the low-level enforcement of street-level drug crime, petty crime and recidivism, and the overdose work that we were doing. There is also, of course, an irrefutable...
Excuse me, Misty, but your time is up. Thank you.
Okay. I'm happy to pause there for questions. I'll just wrap up this last thought. The positive impact on public safety is quantifiable in the case of New York. Between the two sites, we've removed over 2 million units of hazardous waste from the parks and public spaces in New York City, because none of the paraphernalia that is dispensed to people within the site to use there leaves the building. Beyond that, we're doing a lot of drug testing in partnership with the health department and relaying that information to PD as well. So we're able to do a little bit of mapping within the city in partnership with law enforcement about overdose and fatality hotspots and triage those really effectively in partnership with the Overdose Prevention Center. I'll pause there to see if you have any questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kaylin. Good to see you again. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for hosting both me and Representative Mara a few days ago. I think it was a week ago, but all the days have become one big.
It was my pleasure. It was great to have you with us.
I wanted to ask you a quick question. Could you talk to us a little bit about the financial component and the support component, if you feel comfortable, about how it's sustained? And it's important, because we had our commissioner and others tell us that it's going to be difficult even with the opioid settlement fund.
Yeah, that's a great question. So as we've seen from our partners in Rhode Island, and we now have the New York example, there are multiple funding pathways available and in practice for overdose prevention centers. Rhode Island, as you know, is using the opioid settlement fund money. We're not doing that yet in New York State, but we intend to, and we're continuing to advocate for that at the state level. Our partner and our strongest funding partner has been New York City Department of Health. They've been instrumental in allowing us to not only support the overdose prevention centers, but really co-locate the overdose prevention center within a larger harm reduction hub, offering closed loop service provisions. So co-locating medical services, mental health services, holistic services, additional harm reduction services, and the overdose prevention center all in one space. Where the sticking point is, of course, funding the activity of observing consumption. But when you look at a time and effort breakdown of the activities that are occurring within the room itself, within the overdose prevention center itself, what you find is that it's really a minute amount of staff time and effort that is actually expended for the activity, the actual act of observing consumption. Comparatively, every other activity that takes place in that room, whether it be safer use training, wound care, overdose prevention, overdose intervention, care planning, connection to case management, medical care, cleaning, stocking, staff training, et cetera, are all funded activities and widely acknowledged to be evidence-based public health harm reduction interventions for people who use drugs. 98% of the activity that happens within that room falls under that category of fundable activities. So we are very grateful to the robust financial backing of New York City Department of Health for the vast majority of our efforts within the Overdose Prevention Center and beyond its doors in other parts of our building. What is still under contention is that last 2% of effort. But having said that, I think the point I'd like to make is that the health department, as a legal, as a funding partner for this work, will be an important asset for local jurisdictions who are considering mounting these sites. Really, what we're seeing at the federal, state, and local landscape is that strong backing from city, local jurisdictions where these problems are happening at a micro level, and just beyond them at the state level, will really win the day for overdose prevention centers.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things, because when we visited the site, you're helping individuals with their social work. There's a care coordinator. There was behavioral health support. There was mental health treatment. There was physical health treatment. You're taking care of individuals' wounds. There was a place for them to rest at times. There was also nutritional support. There was, along with that, you had somebody to do hairdressing as well as laundry services. This, it's all of them under the very, very small part of observed consumption. That's the part that actually is under contention, but everything else is part of a comprehensive care of individuals who need the care and love. Is that a fair way to put it?
That's a fair way to put it. And I'm really glad you're not under a 3-minute time limit, because I couldn't fit all of that in. But yes, it often, we're very fond of saying the least interesting thing that happens in our harm reduction hub is actually the drug consumption itself. Interestingly, and this is sometimes a little bit difficult for people philosophically to wrap their heads around, it's allowing the activity of drug consumption to occur that provides us a platform for engagement with this population that no one else has. Because there are no other sites in the U.S., it's difficult for us as a public to take this leap together. But for people who have operated consumption sites in other parts of the world, what we know fundamentally to be true is that this is an engagement tool unparalleled by any other. Oftentimes, people visit the site multiple times a day. For instance, in New York, the average visit to the Washington Heights site is 51 minutes. The average length of a visit to the East Harlem location is 38 minutes. If you sort of multiply that by 1, 2, 3, 4 visits a day, you now have a captive audience open to additional services, medical care, mental health care, discussions about medication-assisted treatment, discussions about tapering, maintenance, reduction, housing, dental work, podiatry, holistic care, hygiene, all of it. You have a captive audience willing to listen to you know, trusted healthcare professionals, because that's what people who work in these sites are, sort of guide them and accompany them when they are ready for further care. A case management session, by comparison, is maybe 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, once a day, once a week. And we see people much more frequently and for much longer duration.
That was Kaylin C., Senior Director of Programs at OnPoint NYC, the first legally authorized safe consumption site in the United States, testifying before the Connecticut General Assembly's Joint Committee on Public Health on March 22nd in support of SSB No. 9, an act concerning health and wellness for Connecticut residents. At the time, that version of SSB No. 9 allowed for the establishment of safe consumption sites. You also heard the committee chair in that, State Senator Saud Anwar, MD. While we still have time, here's Representative Tracy Morrow with questions for Kaylin C.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Kaylin, thank you so much for coming and speaking with us again. And it's really nice to see you here. And thank you for the tour the other day. And once again, your enthusiasm here at almost 10 o'clock at night has excited me. So I think I needed a little uplift. So appreciate that. One of the things, and I think you did just kind of mention this just now, but you stressed this when we visited you, is how important that outward facing unit is. Could you explain just a little bit of what that actually does? And you don't have to go into big details, but just kind of briefly.
Yeah, thank you. The underlying philosophy is that we open these programs for two distinct stakeholder groups. We open them for the people who will use them, of course. We also open them for the community members who live and conduct their business, go to school, go to church in the neighborhoods where these programs are located. And from our perspective, if you are not meeting the needs of both stakeholder groups, you have not done your job. So a well-run overdose prevention center should integrate into the tapestry of the neighborhood really well. It should make itself useful, and it should be a community member with sort of equal responsibility to the neighborhood as the other stakeholders and, you know, city agencies where they're located. So the outreach and public safety teams, that's what we call them, they do the labor of cleanup in the communities. That's important. They need to be seen to doing the labor of cleanup. They work really closely with elected officials, principals, parents, the business administration, the city, et cetera. They should be, and certainly ours are, they should be able to talk paint off a wall. They have to be really good and understand the issue, and they have to be able to understand community concern. And they also man our public safety hotline. So again, in an effort to be useful to other stakeholder groups, I think for you guys, it's 211. In New York City, it's 311. But when the community calls and says there's syringes here or there's a person who's intoxicated in my doorway, you know, do something about it. 311 often can't respond to for 72 hours. And that's, you know, in the interest of community well-being and good relationships and being a good neighbor, that's not going to quite cut it. So our public safety hotline guarantees a response within an hour during our hours of operations and within 4 hours if you call when we're not open. Absolutely critical that they be out there hearing and feeling what's going on in the neighborhood, tracking the migration of people who use drugs through our community spaces, working closely with police, reporting back to us how our services are impacting the community as a whole. You'll remember this because I remember it really shocked you when you arrived at our site. There is a daycare center across the street from the largest consumption site in America, and they are a good partner to us and we are to them. Our site in Washington Heights is located a block and a half away from 7 schools and is across the street from a playground. Is this ideal? Absolutely not, but it's a symptom of an urban environment, and we have found our way to integrate with these communities and be useful. Our outreach and public safety team is present at school drop-off, at lunchtime, and at pickup after school. We know the principals, we know the parents, we are there loud and proud, not hiding what we're doing, but being really transparent that we as a neighborhood, as a community, are in this crisis together, and we have to get through it together. We host interns from the high schools, where I think we're the only harm reduction program in the United States that does that. And I could go on, but in the interest of brevity, it is possible to have good community relations and be an asset to your community when you run programs like this.
Thank you so much, Kaylin. Really appreciate your answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Thank you. And I just wanted to mention that both Representative Mara and I almost passed out when we saw the daycare right in front. We were taken care of immediately, and then we learned about how things were working.
That was Kaylin C., Senior Director of Programs at OnPoint NYC, and State Representative Tracy Mara. They were at a public hearing on March 22nd before the Connecticut General Assembly's Joint Committee on Public Health regarding SSB number 9, an act concerning health and wellness for Connecticut residents. Now, SSB 9 made it through the committee with language allowing safe consumption sites, made it through the House, but that language was removed on the Senate side. This new version of SSB 9 was approved by the Senate on June 5th, so that bill is now in concurrence between the House and the Senate. If a final version is approved by both sides of the Assembly, then that bill will go to Governor Lamont. It was a good effort, and hopefully it'll go farther next time. But for now, it does appear that Connecticut will not become the third state to approve safe consumption sites. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed
war on drugs. Drug Truth Network, for this now, is Doug this McVeigh is Doug asking McVeigh you to examine so our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.